This is Talk Is Cheap with Wendy Snyder and Redbeard of the West Coast Uhuru Solidarity Movement.
My name is David Reardon, known in the Uhuru Movement as a Redbeard. Glad to be sharing this time with you.
You know, what we see is like all the students in motion right now, you know, to free Palestine, and the bravery and the courage of the students putting their bodies on the line on campus, and the smear campaign and the slander against the students for taking that stand. And our interest in the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is to help people, you know, make that connection. The title of this study is Overturning White Settler Colonialism and Why White People for a Free Palestine Should Join in Principled Solidarity with African and Indigenous Liberation. So
okay.
You were talking to me, you know, a couple days ago about why it's so important for us to deepen this understanding of you know, not only like the connection between, you know, the anti-colonial struggle against Zionist settler colonialism, but the anti-colonial struggle, you know, right here.
Got
you.
Right.
So yeah.
Okay. So what we're learning from the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party is that the dominant dynamic in the world is the colonial mode of production. And he and we can trace the advent of colonialism at least back 600 years to Portugal. And that dynamic, the colonial mode of production, has been dominating the world from our point of view since then. And there are a few different forms of colonialism that we've learned about. Direct colonialism, the British would go to Kenya, and they would, through armed force, take over the land and the economy and control the labor, and they would have British governmental officials, or in that day, economic officials, that would be on the ground controlling the situation, but the Kenyans would still be there. And then there is settler colonialism, such as in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the United States, where the colonial, the government and economic officials didn't stay in Europe. They came here and displaced, usually by genocide, the indigenous people. And then here we have settler colonialism. Oh, maybe that's what I was just talking about. So then we have, according to the African People's Socialist Party, black people in the United States are Africans, and they constitute a domestic colony, which is to say, when they got on the boat, they were Africans. Therefore, when they got off the boat, they were still Africans. Mm-hmm. And they were forcibly removed from Africa and brought here and constitute an internal colony. And we have an article from the San Francisco Chronicle, and the link online is from another source, UCLA, I believe.
So you want me to pull that up? Because I was going to go through these slides next.
I'm just saying we have it.
Okay.
We have this article.
And I'll put the link in the chat.
To
figure out how to do that.
Give some... to flesh that out a bit, but the thing I wanted to say about the student protests and our job as members of Uhuru Solidarity Committee and supporters of African People's Socialist Party is the students are, we don't know everything that the students understand. We see their banners. They're against genocide. They're for freedom of speech. They're against police brutality. But what we're all really struggling against is the colonial mode of production. We are all in the grip of colonialism. Most of us just see what's happening on the surface, the police, the genocide. But what we've learned from African People's Socialist Party is the foundation of all this is the colonial mode of production. And so our job is to deepen our understanding and the understanding of people who come into contact with us.
Excellent. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'll go back a little bit in the slides I made, just because I made them and I want to show them, but they kind of, you know, just add on to what you've said. And I think I'll just go back and just say, you know, all of our understanding here really does come from, you know, there's so much out there in the world, and I wanted to just show these interesting books that I have not read.
Gerald Horne.
But I want to read, and they just, they like you were saying a couple days ago, they support the thesis and the theory of African internationalism with all these facts that show, like, the understanding that, you know, that the African People's Socialist Party has. And so we do want to salute Chairman Omali Yeshitela for making reparations a household word and developing that theory. I just wanted to show, you know, the books that he's written over the years in developing the theory. And we're not going to go into all the principles, but like you said, like, there's, and then the African People's Socialist Party formed the African People's Solidarity Committee, and we're part of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, and there's so much to say about that, but we don't quite have time. But we are building a march against genocide in October, and we hope people in Eugene, in Portland, in Seattle, in Puget Sound area, Southern California, will join us in Oakland on October 19th. And so, you know, you described, you know, a little bit about, like, imperialism, colonialism, you know, all, actually, you mentioned domestic colonialism, right, that African people are facing, but there's also something called neocolonialism. But all these kind of point to this understanding that you mentioned, the colonial mode of production that Chairman Omali Yeshitela has introduced, that I think is super helpful, because otherwise we kind of get caught in all these terms. There's so much, I mean, colonialism is everywhere, right, on the planet. So,
well, it goes deeper than the terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're learning from the chairman is that a mode of production is something dynamic, and the basic mode of production is to reproduce life.
Yep.
And colonialism has determined what lives get reproduced and what lives don't get reproduced.
Absolutely.
And how those lives who are allowed to be produced, whether they're colonized people or white people, how those lives will be. You know, it goes right back to the basic of life and death. To me, there are two things that were important about this. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's called Racial Economic Gap Slims at Snail's Pace. And it is the result of a study done at UCLA's Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies. And it studied the years 2000 to 2020. And it determined that in all significant economic indicators, Black people are lagging. And that at the rate Black people are gaining what we would call equality, it will take them nearly 248 years to achieve what we as white people have today.
Mm.
The reason I found this important is because we spend a lot of time talking about the theory of colonialism and the idea of reparations. And I think this article shows the effects of colonialism on African people. Mm-hmm. And it also advocates for reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess thirdly, there are people, powerful Black people, such as the mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, who are blocking any progress towards reparations. San Francisco has and the state of California, both commissions to study reparations. So the movement for reparations is trying to break out, and these neo-colonial, which is to say white people with black faces, black people for white power, whatever, they are blocking it. They're blocking it. And there's a lot of really good information here. And ironically, this columnist, Justin Phillips, he's the main black columnist in the Chronicle. And he's a relatively grassroots guy, and I've sent him stuff. But in two different parts of the article, he states, still, the data speaks to the need for revolutionary intervention. And then again, he says, California has to take revolutionary steps. Now, there's a bit of hyperbole for Justin Phillips to be talking about revolution, I'm pretty sure. But maybe not. Maybe it's prescient. And we in the Uhuru movement know that the African People's Socialist Party has been calling for revolution from the beginning. You know, and now to see, you know, just an ordinary columnist even use the word revolution, you know, in conjunction with reparations, I think indicates that the struggle is trying to bust out, you know?
Yes. So this is a San Francisco Chronicle journalist?
Yeah, Justin Phillips.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Pretty grassroots kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And he's the only one who really represents the black community in the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah, it's good to know, because maybe he's somebody who can cover, you know.
He could. I mean, I've sent him a lot of stuff, so he knows.
Yeah.
And then just one more thing.
Yeah.
I think it's really important that we are able to combine theory and ideology with facts on the ground in the here and now. Mm-hmm. So people don't think we just have our heads in the clouds, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll read. Key takeaways. Despite gains in the quality of life for Black Californians over a 20-year period, racial inequality continues to persist compared to other racial and ethnic groups. Black California saw an average of 21.7% growth in socioeconomic outcomes based on the equality index, but still have the lowest index score of all racial minority groups and a 30% lower score than white Californians. For the first time in decades, the Black Californian population decreased in size from 2.2 million to 2.1 million. Black Californians also moved out of urban centers to places like the Inland Empire and Sacramento. And then the biggest improvements in outcome were bolstered by policy changes, particularly in relation to education and criminal justice. I mean, certainly we've seen this happen in Oakland, you know, where droves of people come in to live here to live close to tech jobs.
Yes.
And push out the black community.
Yes.
Right.
And in Oakland, push out the black community onto the street to live in tents.
Yeah.
And teeny houses.
What I've also found is like the language here is so detached, you know, And so when, you know, we kind of translate into the understanding we have, you know, it's like racial and what terms they use? Just racial inequality even doesn't really tell you, you know, what's going on. And
actually, I think it tells us
something.
What's going on, but it doesn't tell us why it's going
happening.
On.
Yeah,
and I think that's the value of being in the Uhuru Solidarity Committee and being connected to the African People's Socialist Party is these are indicators of a colonial relationship.
Yep.
There's no other way to explain why after decades and maybe even centuries of black people struggling,
yep,
that they are still this far behind. It has to be systemic, you know, and it has to be systemic. And the call for reparations is a call to repair that systemic relationship. And I mean, the three of us and many of us, maybe even the folks on the screen, have been around long enough to realize something has to be done. We have to understand this and do something about it. And think that the colonial relationship gives us that understanding, and the call for reparations gives us something to do about it.
And what would be your message to the students on the campus? Say we go to UC Berkeley tomorrow, why should they join the Uhuru Solidarity Movement? Those who are in the encampments and call for free Palestine.
Well, okay, that's a really good question. Mm-hmm. We understand that the Palestinians are the victims of settler colonialism.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that the Africans, black people in this country, are the victims of domestic colonialism. So the similarity there is the colonial relationship. Europeans colonizing other people.
Yep.
We cannot defeat the Israelis in Gaza because we're not in Gaza. We're in the United States. Mm-hmm. So if we are serious about struggling against colonialism, we have to do it right here.
Right. But the students would say to you that the divestment and the boycotts and the, you know, the sanctions, all that is going to have an impact on Israel and on the U.S. and is having an impact.
Well, so it's going to have an impact on Israel, not necessarily on the U.S. The U.S. is a behemoth economically.
Right.
And probably is able and willing to let Israel go if the price gets too high.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So if we're serious about settler colonialism, we have to make the price too high for the United States here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
They'll let Israel go in a heartbeat if they think it's threatened.
And in fact, Israel is starting to partner with Saudi Arabia, right? Mm-hmm.
They're trying to work it out, but it's, you know.
Which is interesting because, you know, talk about not a democracy, right? That the U.S., another not a democracy that the U.S. supports, you know.
I have this other thing I raise when I stand out on a street corner with my sign, which is, and I actually learned this from African People's Socialist Party way back when I joined. They said, well, if you're serious about struggling against imperialism, why are you talking about Latin America? You could struggle against imperialism right here. Mm-hmm. So if we're serious about settler colonialism, mm-hmm. we should do that here. And one reason, I mean, of course, there are very good reasons to be in solidarity with the Palestinians. I'm wearing a keffiyeh, and we are working in solidarity. But it enables white people not to look at our own settler colonialism. Mm-hmm. The more we focus outside and far away, the easier it is not to see what's happening right here. I tell people on the street corner, you know, we're standing on the street corner next to this park. I tell DuBose Park in San Francisco, you know, if it wasn't for settler colonialism, all those people playing frisbee over there would be Ohlone people.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to also piggyback on that, something that you said when you were out there on May Day, Workers' Day, with the comrades from another organization, let's just say, they were invoking somebody, some white worker.
Yeah, you know, a very important white worker.
Okay, an important white worker. And yet they weren't talking about the Ohlone people and the attacks, you know, on the stolen land of the Ohlone people.
Yeah. And they were advocating for workers' rights, and they were describing the oppression of workers, which is all valid, but they weren't acknowledging that the Africans stolen from Africa were workers. And they came here and they worked and they didn't get paid.
Awesome. Well, Curtis says in the chat, thank you, Curtis. We have our study going on here online too. In the book, The Many-Headed Hydra, they talk about the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. They are forced to work for the capitalist owner instead of themselves. We should all stop working for the imperialist. Yes.
Definitely.
Yep. Yeah. And that's exactly what we're about. We're not talking about reforming a system that is... It brings death and destruction to the planet and to peoples all over the planet. Not.
But we are talking about dual power.
Yes.
Because we have to work for the capitalist. It's a capitalist system. I have to pay to rent. But at the same time, in terms of dual power, we're working for the Uhuru movement. We're working for reparations. We're working to support the Black Power movement.
Yeah, I know. Like, how do we not partake in this system where we're dependent on it? But that's the point, is building the African party, African People's Socialist Party, is building an independent African economy.
We're here as a result of the work of Chairman Omali Yeshitela, who is actually facing 10 to 15 years in prison. You can grab a Hands Off Uhuru flyer, basically for organizing for African liberation and for having made reparations a household word, not as just some kind of pittance or hush money, but as a revolutionary demand. And he actually built the African, he built a theory over a long period of time called African internationalism that really takes like this understanding of colonialism, imperialism, actually, you know, the foundation of this whole system on slavery, enslavement of African people and genocide of indigenous people, and built, you know, has built many organizations. And we'll have some announcements at the end, so you'll know how to get involved and how to join and that kind of thing.
Imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism, in which production is concentrated into international monopolies. Finance capital is used to ensure profits from colonization, and the territorial division of the world is completed.
Is complete. So this is a definition that came from the Red Nation podcast.
Because we've been talking about the mode of production. Is mm-hmm. that the mode of production where production is concentrated in international monopolies? To finance capital, and I mean, is that what we mean partly?
Yes, definitely. Okay. And it involves power. So the ruling class, the financial monopolies, they're controlling, number one, they're controlling production, and number two, they're controlling what happens to what is produced. They determine what is produced. And in terms of that definition, there are that is one way to understand what's happening in the world today between Russia, China, the United States. The United States is struggling to maintain its hegemony that it gained by winning World War II.
Yeah.
And then it controlled, except for China, it pretty much controlled the world economy until about 1970 or so, probably until it was the Vietnamese defeated the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. And other, of course, other peoples and nations are always struggling for their liberation and sovereignty. And so there was a multi-decade period where the U.S. Fostered coups, invaded other countries, kept trying to push them down. But now we're at the stage where there's significant conflict. The U.S. is trying to regain its hegemony mm-hmm. in terms of that definition. And that's underlying the struggle between the United States, China, Vietnam, Iran, Venezuela, Russia. It's really not about freedom and democracy. It's about economic hegemony and political control.
Yeah, I would say that when I first heard about imperialism, like, the examples that a good friend of mine who was studying political economy kind of taught me that it was came down in the form of like the World Bank structural adjustment programs, where they would lock, you know, all these countries in Africa and Latin America into these loans that would just indebt them. And then, you know, they talk about third world debt, which I always like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Like the first so-called first world has stolen from the so-called third world. Why would they owe, you know, the U.S. or in Europe? So, but then I understood that it was like, you know, the world has been turned upside down in that way. And all these nations, so-called developing nations, which actually Chairman Omali Yeshitela said this morning, he's like, they're not developing nations. They're overexploited nations. Mm-hmm. right. are indebted to this worldwide system of imperialism. But I do think sometimes people get caught up, and even myself get caught up in, like, okay, we talk about capitalism. But capitalism was formed as an empire, right? From what our understanding is. Would you agree with that, David Redbeard?
I'm still trying to understand that, the difference between capitalism and imperialism. Mm-hmm. The chairman of the African People's Socialist Party contends that the capitalist system was based on the enslavement of African workers. And he references the theory of Karl Marx and the primitive accumulation of capital. Marx contended that you couldn't start the capitalist system without capital.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So where did it come from? And up to this point, we've all assumed that it must have come from the surplus value of the white European workers.
Right. But the guilds and the entrepreneurs.
Yeah. All those people.
Right.
But then the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party has made it clear that it was African workers and the labor of African workers that
stolen
was the primitive
labor.
Accumulation of capital that jump-started the system. And then then the reason we're in Uhuru Solidarity Committee is that we believe the system is still intact. The system still rests on the colonization and exploitation of African people. And if we're serious about overturning the system, we have to be in solidarity with the African independence movement and the freedom and sovereignty of African people, which we understand as white people to be reparations. And then this is, let me say one more thing.
Yeah, sure.
When I first started in the Uhuru Solidarity Movement in about 1978, we studied a book by Dr. Walter Rodney called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa.
Yeah.
So I would really recommend that book for some history on that.
Yeah. No, that's a key book.
It is.
And yes, Curtis, the plundering of indigenous resources and gold. I think that's key. They're like the twin pillars of building this system, or genocide of indigenous peoples and stolen African labor.
Because in order to utilize the labor stolen from Africans, the system needed land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is...
Colonialism is a tool of imperialism used to control and divide territories through military force in order to export capital, circulate financial capital, and develop a strategic infrastructure to maintain economic hegemony over a region.
Yeah, so understanding that imperialism is an overarching system.
Yes.
That's related to creating capitalism, and then colonialism is like the tentacles of imperialism. That's how I see it.
It's not the worldview, but it's it's the overarching kind of, you could see it as a worldview or ideology, and colonialism is the tool through which imperialism manifests.
Yeah.
That's what you see on the ground.
And imperialism, it's like the root is like empire. So
it is like
an empire. Yeah.
Definitely.
Empire with its colonies. And then this definition, which Redbeard, you brought up earlier in terms of like, the example of black elected officials in this area that carry out colonialism.
This was recently printed in the San Francisco Chronicle. It's about a study done on UCLA about how all the indicators of life for African people are lagging behind everyone else. And we understand that to be indication of the colonial relationship. And then in terms of neocolonialism, there is a movement in, there's a commission in San Francisco and a separate one in the state of California studying reparations. But in San Francisco, it's being held back by a black mayor called London Breed. Mm-hmm. And so we understand that as neocolonialism. Mm-hmm. She is working for the white oligarchs that control San Francisco.
But I think it also is such a prevalent strategy that goes along with white liberalism, because, you know, if you have your black friend in academia saying one thing and saying, like, well, don't listen to Chairman Omali Yeshitela because he doesn't know what he's talking about. We have the theory and we're funded, well funded in this institution. Then it kind of goes hand in hand with letting the white people off the hook. They don't have to give reparations because, you know, they can just be the good white person, I guess. I don't know.
Can I add an anecdote here?
Please.
it was at least 10 years ago or more, Wendy, you and I were in a meeting, and Matthew R. Willis, and we went to this meeting because we saw some flyers, something about what white people can do for the black community, something like that. And we went and we laid out basically what we're talking about, because the role of solidarity and the political line of the African People's Socialist Party hasn't changed since I joined in the late 70s. So we were just laying that out. And this African guy, this high profile guy, who now I think works for CNN.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll think of his name.
Van Jones.
Van Jones.
Yeah.
So we stood up for saying, well, this is what we do. This is what we think white people should do. And he stood up and totally derailed it.
Yeah. He actually scolded us for shaming white people and making white people feel guilty. I remember that meeting vividly because he, you know, it was mostly white people.
Yes.
He was only African guy. And he just basically told the white people not to listen to us, that we were shaming, we were guilt tripping, and we should be nicer. Yeah. So
that's, I mean, it's very powerful, that neo-colonial strategy.
Yeah.
So I teach at St. Mary's, and we, one of our readings, you know, there's one of those classes, like a great books class where everybody is reading the same. And we compare an excerpt from, Frantz Fanon on violence, and an excerpt from Hannah Arendt on violence. But this idea, the students are really passionate about kind of recognizing that, well, understanding the relationship between imperialism and colonialism, but then also recognizing that neo-colonialism doesn't necessarily use physical force, but those cultural influences.
Yes.
That's a kind of a general term, but that's where people who look like you, people who can seem to be the best, you know, the best tool to kind of communicate this neoliberal message can be deployed.
Yeah.
And it can be difficult for folks to recognize it.
Yeah.
And you know, it can be confusing because you're not necessarily expecting that. So it's more important. We talk about the fact that it's more important to kind of, you know, to know the facts and pay attention to the message and the alignment of worldview as compared to just kind of assuming, oh, well, if this person looks like me, then they must have my best interests at heart. Underneath in that neo-colonial strategy, that's not the case.
And would you say that sort of identity politics is maybe a term that is used, kind of goes with that, of like rather than...
I think of it more as like representation.
Representation.
And, you know, we used to be able to kind of use a shortcut and say, okay, well, if this person has some characteristics like me, then maybe you know, they'll support my same interest. But I think of identity politics as really recognizing that the personal, what's happening to us as individuals and in this culture, the fact that we're, you know, the victims are are blamed for their situation, recognizing that is it's not a personal failing, it's political.
Yes.
And that these personal conditions we live under are the result of systems.
That's right.
And when we realize, like, my identity, and there's an overlap with yours, and there's an overlap with yours, and we're being oppressed in maybe different ways, but we're being oppressed, then we can kind of, so rather than denying who we are, we can build on it.
Yeah.
That's how I think of it.
Yeah. And Curtis says, they also use war to consolidate wealth for the ruling rentier class. Yeah, absolutely. And I love how much the students now are just exposing, you know, and not just students, but there's been these, you know, protests at Lockheed, and all the weapons manufacturers are just being outed and just like called out. Yeah. And it's beautiful.
I think this polarization is really important.
Yeah.
I think there's a, I was in the trade union movement for a long time, and I was in three different trade unions. And there's something that can happen at a meeting where something has to be voted on and it's contentious. You know, usually you could raise your hand and say aye or nay, but sometimes if it's really contentious, you can call for a division of the house. It means all the people who think this way go to that wall, and all the people who think that way go to that wall. Mm-hmm. So it makes it clear the numbers, but it also makes it clear what side people are. Mm-hmm. Now you can see. You're not just in this room hearing, or the people behind you don't know if they raise their hand or not. Mm-hmm. Now, when you force everyone against the wall, now you can see.
Yes.
And I think that's really healthy.
That is powerful.
So let's see what else we have. So yeah, so I did find a map that's okay. You know, like we could probably create a better map that shows colonialism in the world, but that's pretty good. You know, all that green, which it shouldn't be green. It should be, I don't know what color is colonialism.
Red.
Yeah, like red alert. Yeah, for
that's
blood.
Huge.
But that's huge, you know, and that, you know, we're talking about settler colonialism from Australia to parts of Africa to, you know, and then, you know, we don't want to get caught up in just all the terms, because some of this might not technically be settler colonialism, but it's a colonial mode of production that just continues, like we've been talking about, the imperialist worldview and political economy. Yeah.
And it's a colonial mode of production controlled by the Western powers, understood to be Europe and the United States and Japan.
Just bring it up again, because what Chairman Omalia Shatela of the African People's Socialist Party, founder of the Uhuru Movement, and who really invited, you know, all of us in the Uhuru Solidarity Movement here into the organization, you know, when we each heard them at different years. Mine was 1992, yours was
79,
yours was
2012.
So we heard, you know, the understanding of not just these terms of imperialism, colonialism, neocolonialism, but really a call for people to join in building reparations. And this latest really terminal, it's not new, but it's something, oops, it's something that we've been, Chairman Omalia Shatela has been talking about more and more, is this mode of production, which I think colonial mode of production, which is very helpful, because then we're not just talking about Israel's policies, U.S. policies, you know, policies in California. We're talking about the entire world trying to overturn the colonial mode of production, which I think is super helpful.
Yeah. I did too, and I'd like to reiterate that production, mode of production, it's dynamic, and also what's being produced is life. The basic reproduction is the reproduction of life, and the colonial powers determine whose life gets reproduced and whose doesn't.
Right.
And what is going to be the quality of those lives.
Yeah.
Like right now, there are 700 trucks full of food lined up at the Rafah crossing.
Yeah.
And yet the colonial powers won't let them in, and the Gazans in Rafah are starving.
Right.
They're determining that their life will not be reproduced.
Yep.
Just like that.
Yep. Far.
That's excellent point. Yep. And would you say that the struggle in Palestine is kind of like a linchpin, or how would you describe it in terms of the anti-colonial struggle of the Palestinian people right now, that is, there's a spotlight on it in the world, right? And it's sort of, I don't, it's not a linchpin, but it's like this awakening, you know, for a lot of people are in line with it because they're against colonialism
and
that they're
the
facing.
Word colonialism.
Yeah.
That hasn't been really said in that way.
Yeah.
It's been suppressed.
Yeah.
And the behavior, the ideology of both the United States and Israel is being exposed all over the world. you know,
yeah.
as just being fraudulent and bestial and illegal, whatever you want to say. The United States cannot hide behind freedom and democracy and all that.
Right.
And frankly, Israel can no longer hide behind the Holocaust.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
All that stuff is over.
So can I ask, you all may have discussed this, but what you just mentioned, I had been talking to my daughter about how I always wondered, even from when I was a child, like hearing that the Israeli police would shoot a child, mm-hmm. a Palestinian child, for throwing rocks. And wondering why there was this unwillingness on the part of the United States to ever hold Israel to account.
Mm-hmm.
And it, considering all the aid, you know, mm-hmm. that's been given. And I had just kind of gone through all these possibilities, but I told her none of them had ever just seemed substantive enough. And she said she thinks it's because they both have their origins in this settler colonial history.
Definitely.
There's a support, like an implicit support for their system, because the United States was founded, you know, not in exactly the same way, but mm-hmm. in the same way,
yeah.
the same ideas. And she's 27.
Yeah.
So we have really good conversations, but I told her, I think you're
on to something.
Is that something that you all think you have talked about?
Yeah, we've talked about recently just the settler colonialism here being the original one, mm-hmm. you know, that created indigenous. All the
yes.
others,
yes.
you know.
Genocide.
And even if you look at, like, I don't claim to know all the details, but, like, you look at Occupied Azania, a.k.a. South Africa, right? Didn't they look at Jim Crow to found their
yes,
thing?
They
so,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah, so you can see that the U.S.,
Hitler
what's that?
Looked at how the Africans were treated.
Yes.
By
yes.
The
yes.
United States.
The Nazi
government.
The
United
States.
And
that says it all. That says it all.
Yeah.
Yes.
That
we
says
there.
It all. Yeah.
Right.
And also Namibia, Southwest Africa, was colonized by the Germans, and they committed genocide against the Herero, the Africans. They're known as the Herero people.
That's right.
They literally chained them and threw them in the desert. And I should know, but I don't know how many died. But that was a model for the concentration camps. Nobody talks about that. And I learned that through this movement. I would not have found that information or made that connection without the African People's Socialist Party. So,
right.
Yeah, it's very deep.
Yeah, the chairman of... Have you... heard of her before?
Just the term, but not mm-hmm. this organization.
Yeah, and Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela, he's been around since the 60s. He was in SNCC. And then he, in 1972, he formed the African People's Socialist Party and also developed the theory of African internationalism, which is about European imperialism and also American imperialism, doing what it's done to the world. Yeah.
We started doing a walk against genocide every year, and then we morphed it into a march against genocide. Mm-hmm. And we probably did that for at least 20 years straight, every year.
Wow.
We, in fact, some of the people in here, I recognize they're really young.
Mm-hmm.
But we got we got sponsors. We got our families, our coworkers, we got sponsors, we raised money. You give me $5 for every mile I walk. We did it for at least 20 years. And then we changed to a different format. We stopped the march. I can't remember all the reasons. And that went on for like about 10 years. We didn't do the march. And now we're just now resurrecting it for the first time in a long time, and we're organizing for this march against genocide to occur in as many places as possible, but definitely St. Louis, Missouri, and Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. And the party was calling for those very same things when I was recruited in 1979. The party's been calling out genocide of African people and calling for reparations.
Yeah,
for many, many decades.
Yeah.
their stance has not changed.
But I think the world has changed.
Begrudgingly.
Yeah, a lot of begrudgment.
Yeah.
Especially here in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
There's something called Give St. Louis Day for Uhura Bakery and Cafe. So the national and international headquarters, really, of the Uhura Movement is in St. Louis, Missouri. And that's where Black Power Blueprint exists. That's where they're building Uhura Bakery Cafe. And so I just want to point out to people that this is happening at 4 o'clock on Thursday. You can actually give. They're raising $10,000, but it's a whole capital campaign, right, for several mil, yeah, right? Do you want to mention?
$3 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what will that money go towards?
So, yeah, as Wendy was saying, St. Louis is now the headquarters of the Uhuru Movement and Black Power Blueprint. And Black Power Blueprint has developed so many things in the Black community of St. Louis, like African workforce program with Black people coming out of prison and being able to get skills. And one skill that and training and jobs. And one skill that they really want to do is open a culinary school mm-hmm. in a kitchen, and the kitchen will be called Jico. Mm-hmm. And they bought an old boathouse, an old, like, where they sold boats back, you know, you can tell it's like from the 70s. Mm-hmm. And they're going to convert that into this gorgeous kitchen, cafe, restaurant, and build all these gardens that, and so, like, and really feed. Like, yeah. That's part of is feeding the people nutritious food mm-hmm. And part of their roots, mm-hmm. you know. So that's one project where the capital campaign, they need to raise $2 million or something to outfit Jico. Mm-hmm. And then these other programs is what some of these other programs. We've got a doula training program mm-hmm. and to train doulas coming to go into the community, because in St. Louis, another statistic, the Black mortality rate for babies could fill up 15 kindergartens a year in the Black community. Yeah, that's how many babies die. So 15 kindergartens, that's 30 kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just in St. Louis. So that's part of why have these kinds of programs. That's just one of many. There was a basketball court that was built.
I was there.
Yeah. For the community where the kids can play because they were playing in the street. And so, you know, give them the community needs to safe spot. And also just many different things that are coming up. And this is part of investing in the future of, the future to be able to reproduce life.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And let me say one thing in relation to that. We read this article, and there's all this struggle on these reparations commissions, and there's all this blocking, and but this is happening. Mm-hmm. What we contribute at Give St. Louis Day is a form of reparations. We're not waiting for the commission. The African People's Socialist Party is not waiting for this commission in San Francisco or California to make up its mind. Mm-hmm. They're like, mm-hmm. look,
right.
give reparations now. Here's how you do it.
Yeah.
It's very dynamic. Stuff is enervating. You read the stuff, you're like, who are these people?
Yeah.
And it can be demoralizing.
Yeah.
So it's good to remember that there are other avenues, that there's work already being done.
Yeah.
Once this can be duplicated in every Black community, because we see it like in Oakland, every Black community
it's a blueprint.
Is impoverished because of colonialism. It's a blueprint.
Yeah. The general sentiment of the students is like they are done with supporting a system, you know, that of genocide. And so, you know, just like the title of this study, you know, we want to win people to make all those connections, because people are talking about Kent State as they should.
That's right.
Those students were murdered.
Yes, they were.
And yet, what I've learned from the Uyghur movement is when Fred Hampton was murdered, there was no significant outcry from the white community.
Right.
And we can't let, like, Chairman Omali Ishatella go to prison. We'll talk about this in a minute. Go to prison on bogus charges of being an agent of Russia, you know, and people don't know. You know, if they're going to do it, people are going to know. Hopefully they will drop the charges.
The FBI came in and attacked them in their home and took all, went to the Uhura house and took all the files and covered up. So he's indicted under charges or not.
Indicted, yes.
Under charges of being colluding with Russia.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that's that other flyer, the hands off of Uhuru flyer. That's why we have so many flyers, because, you know, we want to get the word out. And so, yeah, so that's happening. Leonard Peltier mentioned, I know I'm not completely up to date on what's happening, but the man is being denied medical attention. He's almost 80. It's disgusting. And it's like, we want to do everything we can to publicize his case so he gets some treatment. He's having trouble. I think he's blind now. He's a painter, and now he's going blind. He can't eat very well. It's brutal torture that this man is going through. He was, you know, a leader in the American Indian movement who was falsely charged with attacking an FBI agent. But actually, it was the FBI that was attacking the indigenous people. So we will be taking action here locally in San Francisco.
July 29th, 2022,
when the FBI raided 7 different residences and offices of the Uhuru movement, put laser rifles pointed at Chairman Omali Ishatella at 5 a.m. He had to come out of his own home, where he was with his wife preparing for this doula training. You know, it's like, what could be more opposite of, like, they were preparing to support people, you know, reproducing life, and then death comes at their door, just like military vehicles. And so it's been a situation that, involves a lot of bogus charges, and then just waiting for the indictments of 3 members of the Uhuru movement, including the founder Omali Ishatella, Chairwoman Penny Hess, and the chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, Jesse Neville. They're all facing 10 to 15 years in prison. So we do want people to, learn more about those bogus charges, because they don't hold to the light of day. It's like, they're saying they're not attacking free speech. They're saying they're just attacking the fact that that the Uhuru movement is carrying out these overt acts on behalf of Russia, which is a complete, insult to the Black Liberation Movement, and like, they need Russia to tell them, that they're about the oppression of African people. Anyway, so, we're planning on going to Tampa, but even before then, Tacoma's planning a drop the charges event. We had one here in February, but we're also going to just keep carrying that campaign out, because, people need to know about it. And there's been a silencing of, everyone that's for a free Palestine should know about drop the charges against the Uhuru 3, because it's a really important case around free speech. If they are able to convict these 3, leaders in the Uhuru movement, it's not looking good for anyone's free speech. So you want to add to that?
This false charge of working for Russia goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that the U.S. is trying to hold on to its hegemony in the world. And so it has to present Russia as some kind of enemy in order to get the citizens of the United States and the world to support its nefarious activities. So it's interesting to see all the different interrelationships in this thing. But I think the key word is hegemony, and the key understanding is colonialism. Mm-hmm. The United States is desperate to maintain the colonial relationship at all costs. Obviously, the death of women and children in the most blatant manner in front of everyone, they're willing to do that mm-hmm. in order to hold on to their colonial power.
Yeah.
So they're desperate. And I'm also honored to be part of Uhuru Solidarity Movement, to participate in struggling against colonialism and supporting colonized people. Mm-hmm. And I'm really inspired by the students, you know. And mm-hmm. on the way over here, I was having a conversation with an old friend who only saw it in a negative light. Oh, look, they're all getting beat up. Well, yes, they are, but on a certain level, they want to get beat. They allow themselves to get beat up because they realize that's what it takes. They're willing to stand up. It's very inspirational.
Yeah.
Of course, nobody wants to get beat up, but hey, what are you going to do?